So good evening, everyone. Before I start, I just want to check to see who has not been here at all for any of the last four installments of, yeah, I thought so. Okay, this is the fifth of a series. We call these Dharma seminars. Are you here for the very first time ever?
No.
No, I didn't think so.
First time ever.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome to Wednesdays. So this series is based on this new book by Joan Halifax Roshi of Upaya Zen Center in New Mexico. It's called Standing at the Edge, Finding Freedom Where Fear and Courage Meet. And at the risk of being repetitive for those of you who have been here, just to say that it's about how we live and how we practice on the edge, in those what she calls edge states, between fear and courage. Sometimes it's between success and failure, health and illness, life and death, right? Probably everyone here has felt on the edge at some point. In the book, she chooses six of these edge states to structure the book. Altruism, empathy, integrity, respect. Those are the four we've talked about so far. Tonight we're going to talk about engagement and compassion. And these are all qualities, we could say, that support our capacity to stay upright and in balance when we're on the edge. But as we all know, it's easy to slip off that edge and out of balance. Sometimes we crash hard. And you've already seen in the weeks already how these different qualities kind of support each other and help us regain our strength, regain our balance when we do slip. So today we're going to look at engagement, and I'd like to start with a poem. This poem's been around for several decades, I guess, already, published in 1982 by Marge Piercy, but it's an old favorite of mine. It's called To Be of Use. The people I love the best jump into work head first, without dallying in the shallows. And swim off with sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black, sleek heads of seals, bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but who move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire must be put out. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands, crumbles to dust, but the thing worth doing well done has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil. Hopi vases that held corn are put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry, and a person for work that is real. There are so many different kinds of work required to support our daily lives, right? The complexity of it all has grown exponentially from human prehistory, when our basic needs for food, clothing, and shelter and safety were simply met and simply jeopardized when living conditions changed. Now we have whole new industries that arise and dwindle in a few short years. Video rental stores, How long did they last? Apparently in the States, there's a Baroque system of coding medical procedures for insurance purposes that has generated a whole industry of people working just to sort out and assign these incredibly complex codes, because it makes a difference if it's this procedure plus this, how much insurance money gets paid out, versus this procedure plus that. And of course, everyone is trying to use the system to best advantage. And then there's, of course, the meteoric rise of cell phone technology, right? Information technology, artificial intelligence, types of work unimaginable even just a few generations ago. The simple satisfactions of providing food, clothing, and shelter for one's family and one's community have become increasingly distant. And many people don't feel fully engaged in the work they spend the majority of their waking hours doing. Christina Maslach is an expert researcher on workplace burnout. And she says that engagement in our work is characterized by three things: energy, involvement, and efficacy. Joan Halifax in the book says, when we are engaged, we feel nourished by our work. We have personal agency and the means to affect outcome. Outcomes, plural. We have the sense that our work makes a difference to others, ourselves, and perhaps even the world. While it is normal to experience our fair share of frustration and resistance, our commitment to our work, and hopefully our love for our work, gives us the strength and wisdom to ride the waves through less fulfilling times. Another way of characterizing this kind of engagement with our work is wholeheartedness, a kind of undivided, unambivalent engagement. This kind of relates to our discussion last week of integrity being wholeness, not split, not divided, and living in a way that's consistent with our bodhisattva vows. Remember that right livelihood is one of the Eightfold Path, right? Taught by the Buddha as the way to follow, the way to live and practice, to be free from our suffering in this world. So how is it that so many people in our contemporary society struggle with livelihood, are unhappy with their work, and suffer from burnout? That word burnout was first coined by Dr. Herbert Freudenberger, who was a psychoanalyst, in 1974, and he defined it as burnout as a state of mental and physical exhaustion caused by one's professional life, and also, or work life would be better, and also the extinction of motivation or incentive, especially where one's devotion to a cause or relationship fails to produce the desired results. So Christina Maslach, who I already mentioned, created a widely used burnout inventory with questions to see, to measure whether you a person is experiencing burnout. And the three main factors that she measures are exhaustion, cynicism, and inefficacy. So those are the opposite of the three factors of engagement: energy, involvement, and efficacy. I'd say that the opposite of involvement or connection is disconnection. And that cynicism, what she calls cynicism, I think that's a further deterioration of that that disconnection, a deterioration of care and trust in other people, a dulling of empathy. Remember we talked about empathy in relation to burnout and creating a sort of dulling of feeling, which then can erode our integrity. Remember how these linked up? And a diminishment for the capacity for compassion and a caring response. Many cultures have a strong work ethic, don't they? For good reason, you know. How could we function in human families and societies without some value placed on our work? Maybe there are, I haven't done any cross-cultural study or reading on this. I don't know if there are cultures in the world where it's just so easy to meet your basic needs that they don't have a strong work ethic. But certainly, culture I grew up in did. But the addiction to busyness that's so common. How many of you feel like you're too busy? Oh, not too bad. Not too bad. How many hear people mention that frequently? Yeah. Too busy. That's something else. And in our society, it seems that at times, not always, that workaholism is a form of addiction that actually is condoned socially. So that, you know, work colleagues will even kind of compete to display how hard they're working, how busy they are. Halifax quotes the writer Omar Sofi, who says, we live in a culture that celebrates activity. We collapse our sense of who we are into what we do for a living. The public performance of busyness is how we demonstrate to one another that we are important. The more people see us as tired, exhausted, overstretched, and the more they think we must somehow be indispensable, that we matter. So I looked up the essay this came from, in her endnotes. The essay is called The Thief of Intimacy, Busyness. And it generated from this experience. He says, I was sitting in our living room a few days ago with my laptop on my lap, doing what I always do after work, answering emails that don't stop at 5, catching up on business. My little girl, a real love of my life, came into the room in that beautiful way she does. She doesn't so much walk as she skips, she glides, she dances. She walks on her tippy toes because she is, as she says, a for real life princess. As she came dancing into the room, she started to say in her own sing-songy way, Baba, would you like to? At that very moment, she saw me, laptop in lap, locked into my jihad against email, the smallest jihad, the struggle I always lose. She cut herself off. Her dancing came to a halt. Her sing-songy voice changed to something else, something not even resembling disappointment. It was resignation, more like surrender to the rhythm of her Baba's life, knowing the scene she had seen countless times before. Without waiting for my response, she cut herself off mid-sentence, pivoted on her beautiful feet, and walked out. I heard her say, with her back turned to me, Oh, you're busy. So, the thief of intimacy, busyness, was his title. In our Zen practice is often called being intimate with our own experience, moment to moment. To be able to meet each moment fully, wholeheartedly. Perhaps we need to question habitual busyness. What are we avoiding? What are we leaving out? How have we become separated from our values and our aspirations? How can we renegotiate our relationship to work? Sometimes we need to consider not only what we do, but why we do it and how we do it. These questions all begin to relate to right livelihood, and they're not always easy to sort out. It helps to have good Dharma friends who will listen carefully and ask careful questions to help us clarify our thoughts and feelings about work. Sometimes we have to listen deeply to hear a calling from within, asking us to give expression to some aspect of ourselves we've neglected or suppressed. Sometimes it takes courage to let go of a set of expectations that no longer fits and choose a new direction. Another way to renegotiate our relationship to work is to take a lesson from the Zen cook, or Tenzo. I'm just going to read you a little bit from Dogen's instructions to the cook. So Dogen brought this kind of Zen practice, this style of Zen practice, from China to Japan back in the 13th century. And this was the first Zen text I ever read many years ago. I loved it. Instructions to the cook. When you prepare food, never view the ingredients from some commonly held perspective, nor think about them only with your emotions. Maintain an attitude that tries to build great temples from ordinary greens, that expounds the Buddha Dharma through the most trivial activity. When making a soup with ordinary greens, do not be carried away by feelings of dislike towards them, nor regard them lightly. Neither jump for joy simply because you have been given ingredients of superior quality to make a special dish. Oh, neither do that. Yeah. So don't dislike them if they're a little bit, you know, old, or get all excited if you have special ingredients. By the same token that you do not indulge in a meal because of its particularly good taste, there is no reason to feel an aversion towards an ordinary one. Do not be negligent and careless just because the materials seem plain, and hesitate to work more diligently with materials of superior quality. Your attitude towards things should not be contingent upon their quality. A person who is influenced by the quality of a thing, or who changes his speech or manner according to the appearance or position of the people he meets, is not a person working in the way. And then, handle even a single leaf of a green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha. This in turn allows the Buddha to manifest through the leaf. This is a power which you cannot grasp with your rational mind. It operates freely, according to the situation, in a most natural way. At the same time, this power functions in our lives to clarify and settle activities and is beneficial to all living things. What a way to cook. But there's, you know, what he's saying is that there are many ways that our conventional mind discriminates about the value, you know, about the value of what we do, the value of the materials we're given. So sometimes we have to try and make a really good soup out of not the best materials, not the best circumstances, sometimes not even the best tools. Anyone who's gone to a longer Zen retreat knows that work practice is a key component of Zen practice. There's always a work period. And whether you're scrubbing the floor, or chopping carrots, or weeding the garden, or writing tomorrow's Dharma talk, or reviewing the monastery's budget, you give your wholehearted attention and effort to that task, and you offer it to the community, you offer it to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And when the time comes to set that task down, and often it's just when, you know, the next bell rings, whether you've finished or not, you stop. When you set that task down, you set it down. You don't take it into the next thing. You do the next thing just as wholeheartedly. And then when the time comes to rest, you rest thoroughly. giving yourself up to that hot bath or swinging in the hammock. Now we're not at a Zen retreat anymore. Now it's your backyard. The hot bath at Tassajara Monastery in California. You did get to go to the hot spring. They are in a deep valley with a natural hot spring. So after work period, you actually did get to go and soak in the hot bath, which was of great benefit. But you might go in your backyard and swing in the hammock. Or you might take a walk along the riverbank and watch the sun on the river as it goes slowly by. We need to know how to stop working and rest when we need rest, and we need to give time and space to non-productive activity like zazen, which, as we all know, is good for nothing. Nothing but being intimate with body, mind, and heart and world. Non-productive activity is, after all, the definition of play, which is what's on the back of my raksu. Thanks to Michael. Some of you know this story that I'm going to tell you, so forgive me if it's redundant, but the way Michael and I first started Zen practice in Japan was that we were going to university. A Japanese friend was taking tea ceremony lessons at a beautiful old, very old temple up on the mountainside nearby. And he invited us to go along to his tea lesson with the abbot at the temple. So we did. And I was very pleasantly surprised. I thought tea ceremony was a really uptight kind of thing, really made me nervous. The sort of thing that young Japanese women had to do to make themselves more marriageable. So I was not, that interested. But this man was so, put us so at ease. He was so welcoming. It was not uptight at all. I really felt that he embodied maybe the true, more original spirit of tea, the tea ceremony. And after the tea ceremony, sort of towards the end of the tea ceremony, the host explains in a formal Japanese room, there's something called a tokonoma, which is a kind of little raised platform, a little alcove, and usually there's a scroll and some flowers and maybe a little statue. And so typically the host will describe what's in the tokonoma. And he turned to the scroll and said, this is the character for play. And he said, this tokonoma serves a purpose in the Japanese room of non-productive space. And he said, that's what play is. And that's what zazen is. It's a space that's free of the drive, the purpose of our ordinary activities. Well, he won me over. And then we started practicing. We started going up the mountain and practicing with him. Later we moved to Kyoto and practiced with a Soto Zen teacher. This was a Rinzai teacher. And mostly it was just people from the farming villages who came and sat, and he gave a little Dharma talk in Japanese. I will be forever grateful for that gentle introduction. In the time and place where we live, we have more latitude to determine the work we do than probably any other time in human history. The vast majority of our ancestors would have had little option but to follow in the footsteps of their parents and grandparents, right? they were peasants, they'd continue to be peasants. If they were skilled craftspeople, you know, they would apprentice. Or if they were rich landowners, they would try not to have their fortunes slip. And women would continue to cook and bake and raise their children and work in the fields. And there were many kinds of laborers. You know, for a very long time in human history, even today, our range of options can be limited by our gender, age, race, ethnicity, sexuality, physical and mental capacities. But overall, we have an incredible range of choice. The degree of personal freedom that we now take for granted also comes with a certain amount of angst, right? What am I going to do with my life? You know, what kind of work should I choose? You know, it's maybe not this. Maybe there's something better. This isn't quite it. What is our real work? To use the phrase of the great American poet Gary Snyder, this is a book of essays called The Real Work from 1970-something. Goes way, way back. Here's what he said in an interview way back then. What exactly is the real work? I've used that phrase a few times before. And then I asked myself a lot, what is the real work? I think it's important, first of all, because it's good to work. I love work. Work and play are one. And that all of us will come back again to hoe in the ground or gather wild potato bulbs with digging sticks or hand adze a beam or skin a pole or scrape a hive. We're never going to get away from that. We've been living a dream that we're going to get away from it, that we won't have to do it again. Put that out of our minds. We'll always do that work. That work is always going to be there. It might be stapling papers, it might be typing the office, but we're never going to get away from that work on one level or another. So that's real. The real work is what we really do and what our lives are. And if we can live the work we have to do, knowing that we are real and it's real and that the world is real, then it becomes right. And that's the real work, to make the world as real as it is, to find ourselves as real as we are within it. To take the struggle on without the least hope of doing any good. To check the destruction of the interesting and necessary diversity of life on the planet so that the dance can go on a little better for a little longer. There's Gary Snyder. Sounds as fresh as when he wrote it how many decades ago. I don't think we will be able to leave the real work behind, even if robots threaten to take it all away from us. They will break. And we might need to go out and, you know, with our digging sticks and dig up some tubers to eat. So we better not forget. Another great American poet and friend, longtime friend of Gary Snyder, Wendell Berry, wrote this, probably in deliberate homage to Snyder. He wrote, "It may be that when we are no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings." Have you ever moved stones around in a little creek to change the music a little bit? The impeded stream is the one that sings. So when we feel impeded or constricted in our work, we need to pause and listen. What song do you hear? How can you dance along with it? What will you sing in response? So thank you for listening for now, and